Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We have a really full house, which is good. We have a lot of really smart people here to help us figure out what's going on in the state of Georgia, up in Washington. And we also have to look in again on the Atlanta mayor's race, since it's heating up rapidly because early voting starts on Monday. Greg Bluestein, who is the lead political reporter for the AJC, if for no other reason than he files more stories than anyone else in the paper. Greg, we're glad to have you here today.
Glad to be here.
I always like to ask people what they're working on. What are we likely to see under your byline tomorrow?
I don't know about tomorrow, other than the Kasim Reed endorsing Keisha Lance Bottoms story.
Which we'll talk about at some point.
Yeah, but there's a couple things for the weekend about the first day of early voting for the mayor's race and about Georgia's hunt for Amazon. The deadline is next week.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. Patricia Murphy is back with us. Patricia, at one point worked up on the Hill with Max Cleland, Senator Max Cleland, and has gone on to a pretty strong career, fine career as a journalist, a columnist for the Daily Beast and Roll Call. And would you like to tell us, you've added another publication to your portfolio?
Yes. Garden and Gun magazine. I'm doing a weekly online column for them, which I'm super excited about. And it's not political. It's just for the other half of my brain that is not political and likes to think about things sometimes other than
culture?
Donald Trump.
Some culture,
et cetera. There's a country song about a woman with three jobs and a rundown kitchen, and I'm just trying to live up to it.
Garden and Gun, obviously a really prestigious publication.
Thank
Congratulations.
You. I'm thrilled. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Mark Roundtree, Landmark Communications. He's one of the best known, and I think we've always said, Mark, a pollster who people tend to trust when much of the polling that we see around the state and the country isn't as accurate as yours tends to be. So we're glad you're here.
Thank you very much.
Mark is polling the Atlanta mayor's race for WSB TV Channel 2 here in Metro Atlanta. They're actually going to release a new poll early this evening. And as much as we have tried to force Roundtree to tell us what that poll
shows, to pry it out of him,
he refuses to do it because he'd rather get paid by his client than give away free information to Political Rewind. But we will talk a little bit about the trends in the mayor's race later in the show. And Sam Zamarripa is back with us. Sam, former Democratic state senator, who's gone on to be an entrepreneur in Metro Atlanta, but still very involved in community organizational work, has done a lot in the Hispanic and Latino community. And Sam, you're an author now. Your book is The Spectacle of Let, the Aliyet and Obit.
That's right. Five years in the making. This is book one of two.
The untold story of a one-word poem, the first spoken word of God.
Yeah.
So what is it? Tell us quickly what it's about.
Well, this is in the genre of magical realism. So in addition to my political career, which I loved and grew from, I have found a little new voice in literature and plan to do that for the next decade or so.
All right. Well, congratulations on the publication of that book. A couple of items in breaking news. A number of news organizations now are reporting in just the last little while that President Trump is about to name a new Homeland Security Secretary, and it will most likely be Kristjen Nielsen. She came into the Oval Office with John Kelly as his right-hand person, and her reputation, Patricia, is she's the real tough one in the Oval. She's the one who folds her arms and says,
yes.
No, you're not going to see the president. You'll do what we tell you to do.
She might be the three-star general in the Oval Office right now. Very well respected. And if she comes with John Kelly's endorsement, I think she'll do very well in her confirmation proceedings if she's nominated.
All right, we'll watch TV. Yeah. Also, a story that we'll talk about later, but breaking news. President Trump, today NBC News had a fascinating, they call exclusive story about President Trump and his relationship to nuclear weapons. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the fact that President Trump is now responding to NBC in a relatively precipitous manner. We'll get to that a little bit later. Let's start, Greg, here in the state of Georgia, if we can. Your colleague, Christina Torres, wrote a piece in the AJC in which she says that having talked to lawmakers down at the state capitol, she sees no reason. She doesn't see from them any suggestion that as a result of Las Vegas, they're going to pull back from trying to further expand some gun laws in Georgia in the next session and beyond.
Yeah, and this follows a pattern in the Georgia legislature. There's often Democratic bills to rein in gun permits and try to ban certain types of weapons, and they usually get no traction. And there's also proposals from conservative lawmakers to relax some of the restrictions. And as we saw, especially this past year with the campus carry bill getting adopted, those do get wide support. And this is probably no different. I mean, there's a few bills out there, but generally they would ease restrictions on carrying firearms in places like state parks and historic sites by saying that you don't necessarily have to have a permit to carry those weapons in state parks and historic sites. You just have to be eligible for a permit, which means you have to be of a certain age. You can't have a felony. As long as you meet those requirements, you can carry your gun in a state park.
Christina quotes Speaker Ralston saying, "What happened in Las Vegas is a horrific tragedy. Families have lost loved ones, and the nation is grieving with them. It is both premature and reprehensible to inject politics into what are personal tragedies until this investigation is complete and while families are mourning." Sam Zamarripa, that's been kind of the standard response of those who really don't want to see much in the way of prohibitions for gun use.
Yeah, this is just a comfortable area for the Republican leadership. They know how to talk about it. They know how to address those that oppose it. So for them, this is just an easy way to have a headline, to own the space, and to continue to speak to their base.
Mark, what does polling? What have you seen in Greg alluded to the fact that expanding gun carry laws is popular in the state. What have you seen as you've looked at this issue over the years?
Well, needless to say, Georgia's I would consider it a pro-gun state, and I think you put it in terms of though you only need Democrats would need in a statewide election about 30% of the white vote to win. And are there 30% of the people that may care about this issue enough to actually vote on the issue? I would say the answer is yes. They're in a very real minority, additional expanding gun rights, as you could call it. And they're pretty much going to be suburban, a lot of them housewives or stay-at-home moms or working moms. But particularly among females, I think you'd find support for that in Metro Atlanta. And again, you only need 30%.
Wait, I want to make sure I understood you correctly. So you point out, I think, something that's important, that for a Democrat to win statewide, that woman or man would have to have 30% of the white vote.
Yeah.
And you believe, perhaps, that restrictions on guns of some sort could appeal to 30% of the white voters in the state? Is that what you – I want to make sure that's
right.
What I heard you
30,
say.
30% of – again – the Democratic Party of today is not the Democratic Party of the 1970s. In the 1970s, it would have been a disaster among Democrats to propose this in the South, to propose gun restrictions. It could be popular. Democratic candidates could run on this and actually have some success with a small group, very small group of usually Republican voters.
And that's what was so, to me, and it didn't on the face of it, doesn't seem remarkable, but it really was in terms of Georgia politics, remarkable to see both Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams on the day after the Las Vegas massacre call for such gun restrictions, just like you were elaborating on. Because if you look at the recent history of Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidates, Roy Barnes had an A rating with the NRA in 98, right. 2002. Jason Carter voted for the so-called Guns Everywhere bill, the massive guns bill that passed in 2014 and had a very high rating with the NRA as well. And then you have Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans both calling for new gun restrictions. It seems, you know, normal from the face of it, but in Georgia, it's really, you know, unusual.
Patricia, it's a changing world if all this is correct.
Well, and you're talking about two women who made that call. These are, I totally agree with Mark. I mean, and Mark's is, of course, based in actual math and polling and research. but anecdotally, just from my own reporting and my own travels around the state versus my experience inside the metro area, the suburban women who are typically Republicans, typically basically, you know, for lower taxes, smaller government, and really disappointed, verging on extremely angry, particularly about the guns on campuses. And I think that that activated them a lot. There is a group in the state called Moms Rising, which targets on Facebook moms who are very upset about this issue. So I think there is a level of activism among moderate to moderate Republican women against these gun bills in the South, across the country, of course, but in Metro Atlanta, that was not there before. And so I think that that's something to pay attention to.
Meanwhile, and I want to talk about this because it continues what's becoming a running theme on this show. Meanwhile, that may be true in statewide races, that a candidate who embraces some form of gun restriction could attract a significant portion of the white vote. But in the state legislature, there's no winning hand. A state as gerrymandered as Georgia is, guns is not an issue that's going to turn the legislature over, right?
No, I think realistically, we're looking at Republicans probably holding a majority there until at least the 2030s. I mean,
sure.
Through a couple of reapportionments, probably.
Sure. But beyond just whether they win the seats or not, within the district, Republicans have enough support from their base in each district that they don't have anything to worry about in terms of restrictions on guns.
I think that Mark is right, but what you're saying, Bill, is accurate, and that's why I'm saying this is just comfortable fodder. This is just an easy way to fill up the air to talk about guns when maybe there may be more visceral issues out there that could take over. This is easy.
But I will say that the Republicans do not have the united front on the gun issue. If you saw the campus carry vote, a lot of it still easily passed, but there was a lot of pushback from suburban Republican lawmakers representing areas like Dunwoody, representing areas that have a high proportion of higher education, like in Athens, who voted against it.
Although I don't want to interrupt you, Bluestein. I did think it was really interesting in the governor's debate, the gubernatorial Republican debate, that Hunter Hill came out, I mean, if I may, lock, stock, and barrel for no gun restrictions. And yet, although he's from a more suburban district, that seems to be the area where he's trying to stake out. And for a Republican statewide candidate to get the NRA money and endorsement and grassroots activism, I think is still wildly important. So it's interesting on both sides of that.
I have one other thing to add to this. As far as gun restriction and how they may affect a legislative race, there are most of the races we see in Georgia for the legislature are settled in the primary, as those of us, maybe even the listeners know, probably 90%+ of the elections that are out there are settled literally in the primary, not the general election.
Right.
So we're talking about a limited number of elections it could even affect. The reason it matters more at a maybe gubernatorial or even lieutenant gubernatorial level is because those people can actually do something about an issue. People don't hold state legislators to the same standards that they do a governor, even if it's subconscious, because they're one of 200+ voices as opposed to a decision-making executive.
So let's expand this a little bit, if we may. Patricia, you had a couple of columns in Roll Call. One of them was published today that we'll talk about in a little while. But a recent column of yours addresses what we expect. You expect is or is not going to happen in Congress as a result of Las Vegas. And I think you said something really interesting within that column. You ask, what sets gun violence apart from all the other terrible ways people lose their lives when it comes to Congress's willingness to act? If an airline crash had killed 58 people trying to land at the Las Vegas airport Sunday, members of Congress would join together to launch investigations and hold hearings. If more than 500 people had become ill at a Mandalay Bay restaurant, you can almost see the joint press conferences with politicians, including the congressional delegation, assuring nervous Americans the food supply is safe, and you go on from there. Well, what's the difference?
Well, obviously, because as I said in this column, because the weapon of choice was a gun and not a bomb. There's no bomb lobby out there, but there is just an incredibly powerful gun lobby. But, you know, they're doing their jobs. The NRA is doing their jobs. It's the legislators who are, I think, really doing the bidding of the NRA and not listening in some cases to their constituents. But it's just such a politicized issue. They don't want to go near it. And on Capitol Hill, it's literally the only it's the only topic that legislators don't overreact to. And I think you hear the frustration among everyday voters, but until, especially after the Sandy Hook shooting, when nothing happened after that, when there was a, it looked like there were going to be some significant pieces of legislation to pass after the Sandy Hook shooting, and they didn't pass, and there were Democratic votes against it, there's just no leadership on this issue in any direction except to loosen restrictions. And until a legislator believes they can do this and keep their job at the same time, I don't see much progress on
Sam,
it, or
both,
change.
Both Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue have suggested they might be able to support some action that would outlaw the so-called bump stock. Or I always say that back. Is that bump stock, stock, bump stock? That's right.
Bump stock.
That's not much of a remedy, is it?
It's not, but it's a what it is. It's another convenient way to contain a debate that they don't want to have, which is much larger. It's to Patricia's point. It has to do with the symbolic strength and power of the larger issue of mechanized weapons, machine guns, etc. So I think that in some ways this issue that the NRA now has embraced is just a way for them to contain a place they don't want to go.
Well, but again, let's point out that when you say the NRA has embraced it, Greg, they don't want legislation outlawing the bump stock. They want the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to do it with a regulation.
Yeah,
and there's
no
significant
guarantee.
Difference there.
Yeah, there's no guarantee even that happens. And if there is a legislative push for this, there's no inkling from leadership, Republican leadership, that of a timetable of even a draft of this. And when it's news that Republican senators, and in both Georgia senators, Senator Isaacson and Senator Perdue, are both on board for this, when there's news that they're simply receptive to this, it talks a lot about the state of the debate here, that it's news that they're at least open to this debate. Because with so many other legislative proposals to restrict guns, it's a non-starter.
All right. What I'd love to do is get a break in so that we can continue our conversation on state issues and then move on to some really fascinating developments on the national political scene. But let's get that first break out of the way. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Wherever news is happening, GPB takes you there, from here in Georgia to the other side of the world. As Hurricane Irma moved into our state, we suspended our fall fun drive in order to provide you with the latest news and information to help keep you and your family safe. The campaign resumes tomorrow, but don't wait to do your part. Your support now is a direct investment in the coverage you rely on from GPB and NPR day after day. Please go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks.
The new film, The Meyerowitz Stories, is a very contemporary comedy about three adult siblings who share a father but are from two different marriages. It stars Dustin Hoffman, Adam Sandler, and Ben Stiller. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's writer and director, Noah Baumbach, who also made Frances Ha, Greenberg, and The Squid and the Whale. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Pollster Mark Roundtree, former state senator, now author and entrepreneur, Sam Aripa, Patricia Murphy, columnist for Roll Call, Daily Beast, and now for Garden and Gun.
The trifecta.
Wow. And Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC.
And only that.
that's enough, the way you file. Greg, we saw signs in the Republican governor's debate this past weekend that Republicans, of all people, are more and more open than they've ever seemed to be in the past to state funding for transit. And a further development in that came this week when the State House Transportation Committee held hearings, and Representative Kevin Tanner, who's from outlying Dawsonville, said that he's confident that we're going to see some good things happen on mass transit. Isn't that an interesting development?
It is. It is a slow-going sea change from especially just a few years ago, when rural lawmakers of both parties were not interested in funding transit for bigger cities like Atlanta. But now it's being seen as a tool of economic development. You have lawmakers pointing to Fortune 500 companies and giant corporations setting up shop literally along MARTA lines in areas like Dunwoody and Midtown and downtown. And they're seeing it, too, in the context of of further pursuits of companies like Amazon. Amazon's not going to move to an area that doesn't have transit. So it's becoming a, you know, more of a watchword.
I want to make a correction. Don't tweet, don't send me emails. Tanner made those comments during a panel discussion at the American Public Transportation Association, which was in town meeting at the World Congress Center. This did not happen down at the state capitol, so hold your fire, folks. Mark, this is kind of a remarkable development, especially when as recently as a couple of sessions ago, we saw a fight over whether North Fulton County was going to join the public transit bandwagon. And in fact, things went south, despite the fact that Brandon Beach, who lives up that way, was pushing that effort. So things are changing. It's a slow sea change, but boy, it's happening, isn't it?
It is happening. This is one of those issues where it's pretty clear that politicians have somewhat been behind the times of where the city is. The city legitimately supported it in the 70s as far as the actual city of Atlanta and DeKalb. Clayton did not, Cobb did not, Gwinnett did not. We have polled this actually a number of times. I'm going to try to find one just in my computer while we're sitting chatting. The word MARTA actually is a very positive term now in Gwinnett. A solid majority of people like MARTA. So the city, well, now I'm using the term much more loosely, the city of millions in Metro Atlanta actually support the idea of MARTA and support transit. Where it could hurt political candidates if they were to run on the issue is, again, more in primaries, on the Republican side in particular. But I think, frankly, it was one of the mistakes that Jason Carter made in the last campaign. I'm just talking strictly analytically. I think he was for it. I think he made a mistake in buckling to, right off the bat, he proposed a major transportation change in Metro Atlanta. He was vilified, probably correctly, but for being a tax increase guy. He was going to come out for a tax increase to pay for it. He ran away from that and never really came back from it. And I think that hurt his election. I think if he had stuck to his guns on that, he would have made some ground.
So remembering that we have a lot of listeners here across the state in Savannah and Macon and Augusta and other parts of the state, they hear state funding for public transit that mostly will benefit the Metro Atlanta region, and they may have a reason to feel a little nervous about that. So I'm assuming that even as people start to think this is a good idea, the way this is going to proceed most positively is if the effort to do this regionally through regional T-splots continues. Am I right about that, do you imagine?
You know, I was one of the key staffers on the founding of GRETA back in the end of the 90s with the
Georgia
Chamber.
Regional Transport
Correct. And we passed that legislation, and then when Governor Perdue was elected, he altered the returned the legislation to its current form. There's a couple of things that I think are happening that are material. The solutions from 10 years ago about transportation are no longer the perfect fit for Atlanta. It's not going to be just about heavy rail. It's not going to be just about light rail. Frankly, it's going to be about intelligent driving and intelligent cars. And this is a vastly different discussion that might have some kind of political wind behind it or benefit. They might be unique to Republicans and Democrats that you begin to talk about intelligent transportation systems that individuals contribute to, that are a part of, and that could change the landscape then on the kind of funding structure or a rise in gas tax in exchange for something else that would lay the groundwork for transportation enhancements.
All right, but until that wonderful day arrives when I get in my car and tell it to drive me to Georgia Public Broadcasting, and I get that. That is
it's coming.
For those who are looking at the long-range future of transit in metro areas like Atlanta, that's absolutely true. In the meantime, you're also right, I think, Patricia, he's right, that we're not going to build heavy rail lines.
That's right.
There will be some through maybe the Northern Corridor. We'll see how that plays out. But there's going to be light rail. And then there's this bus rail concept, which I always think is just a bus.
Yes.
With a dedicated lane, though.
Fine. All right.
It's true. Well, I think it's going to be helpful. Any plan that could check a box in all 159 counties. So we'll do a little for us. We'll do a little for you. Savannah will do a train for you and a little light rail thing here, there. But it literally has come down to the fact that when employees are interviewing for Jobs in Atlanta. They are interviewing the employer. Where is your building and is it close to MARTA? Do I have to have a car to work in your office? And so those companies internalize that. What building can we be on in that is close to MARTA? How do we do that? Then also you can tell Macon, you can tell other places, et cetera. If we could just get your people within 30 minutes of a MARTA station, people who work in Atlanta could live in Macon. I mean, that happens all over the Washington, D.C. metro area all the time. So I think there certainly is an argument to be made, but it's going to have to include the entire state for sure.
What do you think is going to happen this session, Greg? And what's going to happen? Well, maybe not much this session, perhaps.
Maybe,
but,
though.
Yeah, you think? Even with the governor's race underway?
So Georgia came closest to dedicating state funding to mass transit in 2015 when they passed the new Transportation Investment Act. Mm-hmm. They raised about $1 billion for road repairs. At the same time, there was a lot of debate at the time about dedicated transit funding. Instead of that, lawmakers ended up setting aside $75 million in bonds for transit projects. And that did exactly what Patricia just said. It kind of splashed the pot all over the state. MARTA got money, but so did the Chatham Area Transportation Company. So did Athens Bus. So did smaller bus systems all over the state. I think that a debate over statewide transit companies coming for real. Speaker Ralston's behind it. Lieutenant Governor Cagle, who's probably the Republican frontrunner, is saying left and right that transit should not be a dirty word anymore. But for that to happen, the state needs a seat at the table. The state wants a role in picking the next MARTA chair, some sort of input into how that money is spent.
Well, am I right that Governor Deal has in fact indicated that he would like to have a seat at that table? To be involved in the next, because we are now looking for a new head of MARTA. And if that's the case, that's a very positive sign for transit, it seems to me. Yeah, am I right? Do I read those tea leaves correctly? Everybody's nodding.
Oh, yes.
It's radio.
It's radio. Speaking of favorable, I just did pull the poll that I had done at one point. We had done it for the Gwinnett Village. MARTA's favorable a few years ago was literally about 70% favorable in Gwinnett County, where it's famous for not being popular. It is. Secondly, when we tested, this is the rubber to the road, though, so to speak, the sales tax, we tested would it be favorable to pay for this with a sales tax, and it was heavily rejected, 34 to 60. So everybody wants it, no one wants to pay for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
One other point is this may be politically popular, but it may also be something that actually does not really affect traffic, even if it's politically popular, because people want expansion of transit so that you can, quote unquote, get off my road. Everybody wants to stay in their car as a choice. By and large, I drive around North Fulton. I live in North Fulton. I see MARTA buses in North Fulton, and they are empty at rush hour.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
one is on those buses.
All right. We're going to watch how that unfolds. It's going to be a long march, slow march, as you've described it, Greg, and I think you're right. Let's make a quick note. I don't think there's a great deal we can say about it at this point, but the Supreme Court of the United States has now announced it is going to take the case of the Georgia-Florida water war case. I described it in the note that I sent out to you all. And this is a quiz for our listeners, as being the Southeastern regional version of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. Read your Dickens, read Bleak House if you don't know what I'm talking about. That's a spoof about the longest running case in English law, a fictional account of that as a way to attack the insanity of the British legal system in the middle of the 19th century. But Greg, the reality is this is incredibly important. This thing has been going on for decades, and the longer it drags on, the less we are able to plan our water resources for the decades to come.
Yeah, and Georgia leaders have warned for all those decades that a loss could devastate the state's economy, because it means dramatically fewer water. It could take out water withdrawals. That's the word I was trying to think
of. Permits.
Fewer water withdrawals from Lake Lanier, and which could hamstring company development, which could hamstring new residential permits all over metro Atlanta, while downstream folks, both in Alabama and even in Georgia and Florida, are talk about worries about power plant withdrawals, talk about worries for the agricultural industry and the oyster industry in Florida, and as well as agricultural farmers who are worried about irrigation.
We do have Alabama's out of the case, at least. We've been watching carefully, though. Been watching it all carefully. And Sam and Patricia, we don't have any. The court has not told us when they plan to take up this case. They'll be meeting until early next summer, next June, most likely. So this could come at any time. So we're still more than a year away, in all probability, from getting a sense of what the Supreme Court wants to do about this, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think this is going to be not an overnight response that we're going to get. But it is going to have huge implications also for other states. And I think the reason the Supreme Court is taking this up is because it's not just a local issue. It's a local issue that is happening and replaying itself all across the country. If you look at California and Nevada, you look at Colorado, has all kinds of water wars going on with their own states. And it really is going to solve that existential question, you know, who gets it, you know, upstream or downstream, and it will have just huge implications for the state, but it'll be decided one way or another.
All right, let's move on. While we're in Washington at the Supreme Court, let's go a little bit across town to the White House. We expect that tomorrow at some point, President Trump is going to issue an executive order that he believes will ease costs for health insurance. He's going to allow coverage to be sold across state lines on the theory that doing that will create more competition and force insurance companies to compete on the lines of prices. Sam, in theory, that sounds like a pretty good idea. There's a lot of pushback and a lot of concern, yes?
Well, just so the listeners understand, as long as you cannot cross state lines, then in effect your General Assembly or your legislative body is setting prices, is directly involved in that price setting. So I think the argument is that a larger national framework makes sense for a bigger market. Frankly, I've always supported it, but not in isolation. Because if the insurance companies don't have a policy to underwrite that has a mandated coverage features, then essentially the underwriting is for limited risk, so it does not deliver the benefit that's required.
Well, and that's one of the concerns, isn't it, Patricia, that when that starts happening and you increase competition across state lines, you run into issues, especially if the Republicans get an opportunity in Congress to pass new health care legislation. Maybe insurance companies will be able to cut back on what they offer despite what the Obamacare guidelines tell them they have to.
Yes. Well, this is a promise that President Trump had been making throughout his time on the campaign trail. And when the Republicans rolled out their version of Obamacare repeal, it did not include this. And so then Secretary Price was saying, well, this is just part of an overall package. And later on, we're going to also make it possible to purchase across state lines. So this is something Trump has wanted to do for a long time. I didn't actually know he could do it through executive order. I think there may be a challenge to that. And I'll be really interested to see how the state Republican governors and insurance commissioners react to it. But it's something that Republicans and even some Democrats have wanted to do for a long time. Doing it in isolation, I think, is a problem. And we don't know what's going to happen. I think that's the other problem. It's a big... it's a little bit of a risk to take,
But don't you think at this point Obamacare is finished as far as an actual functioning policy? And this may expedite the death spiral of the Obamacare system. It may expedite it by a number of years. But it is something that at least starts the process to reforming this because, you know, we are ground to a halt in Washington and we're stuck with a system that's failing. I know my insurance for my family would be $1,500 a month on a $12,000 deductible. We're paying $30,000 a year for nothing.
I'm certainly not defending Obamacare as a piece of legislation. I'm just saying I don't know. I think nobody who is deeply involved in healthcare policy knows what will happen the day after this executive order is signed. And I think that's the problem.
The question, why do we have such smart people in Tennessee, including Bob Corker and Lamar Alexander? Lamar Alexander leading the current best thinking on what reform should look like. According to Sam Zamarripa. and let's put the record to reflect, Lamar is still a Republican. But I think Patricia's exactly right. It's the across lines national policy is an interesting idea. A lot of people have been for it, but in isolation is where it gets complicated. I would love to see Lamar Alexander chime in on this one.
Strategically, the way to bring the system down, which is, I think, what they're going to be doing now, is exactly what you're referring to, Patricia. But and that is the change of going cross state. They've already eliminated, essentially through executive order or at least request. I don't quite know the legal structure, but Trump said don't enforce the mandatory tax anymore, the individual mandate at the IRS level. Customization of plans. They're little first base hits that are going to be destructive to this house of cards, this giant pixie sticks castle
that's
been built.
Greg, this is where, and I want to move on from this, but I do want to ask you about this. It is so easy to play the political game about health care, to pit Democrats against Republicans. This is how the Republicans are going to get. What we're talking about here are people, and Mark said it himself, people who are paying outrageously large amounts of money to have insurance. This is a human issue far beyond the maneuvering of two political parties, and we tend to lose sight of that sometimes.
But it's affecting such a small group. I'm sorry, Greg.
Go for it.
Small group of people.
Well, that in the exchanges, because most of us get our insurance through group policies at our workplace.
Self-employed people like myself. Yeah. That's who is being affected, 17 million of us.
And one of the side effects of this, it would set up or would allow more association health plans, trade groups, to get together across state lines.
That's right.
And get together and form their own and carry their own insurance policies. And you're right. I mean, what Bill said earlier, it could destabilize Obamacare, but it also could lead to lower premiums.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest champions of this is actually Senator Isaacson, who I asked yesterday about it, and he said it's not the be-all or the end-all, but it's a Herculean step forward to get some more affordable health care for people who don't have any
access. We expect that EO, the executive order, to come from the president tomorrow. We'll see what it has to say. Greg Bluestein, there are Republicans in Senate, Politico tells us, who are really increasingly nervous about the war of words between Bob Corker and President Trump. And yet, the president, as recently as late last night, early this morning, was tweeting. He's now got a nickname for Corker, Little, with two D's.
With two D's.
Bob Corker. And let me play you something Tom Faust, our producer Tom Faust, listened to. This is beginning, and Patricia, I'll be interested in your take on this. This war is starting to really hurt the Republican agenda, they believe, and it's even leaking over to Fox News, one of the great defenders, typically, of the Republican agenda, and certainly of Donald Trump, now that he's president. Here's Neil Cavuto last night.
It's not that some of your ideas aren't sound. They are. It's that increasingly this erratic behavior is making me wonder whether you are. Now, I know you say that Senator Corker started all of this bad-mouthing you. But last time I checked, you are the president of the United States, so tweeting out these tacky insults, well, it just seems beneath you. And I think it is going to cost you. You're running out of friends faster than you are running out of time. You might not like Bob Corker, but a lot of senators do. And you need those senators. Sir, even assuming some of them have gotten used to this, how long do you think they put up with this? Loyalty works both ways, Mr. President, and whether you think you're justified or not, punching down ain't exactly helping you punch through.
Patricia, you wrote about this in a column published in Roll Call just today.
Yes. I'm just looking at it as a tactic, a leadership tactic, to one by one go through the chairman of the Republican chairman of Senate committees and humiliate and debase them when he has a really incredibly aggressive agenda, an agenda that most Republican senators support and they want to support and they want to get there. They just need a good piece of legislation and a Tuesday to do it. But he is, when I tell you that Bob Corker has never had a fight with another Republican senator, he's probably never had a crossword with a Republican senator. So I think they're having a hard time wrapping their minds around how this has happened between their president and one of the nicest guys in the Senate. Also, what happens if they're next? Also, is this guy okay? And you literally hear conversations among Republicans to say, they almost discuss the president almost like he's sort of like the crazy uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner table. There is just a level of, it's not disrespect, I think it's genuine concern on some level, but you don't hear it publicly, and Bob Corker is saying it publicly, and that makes them very uncomfortable. Also, they all get asked about it every time it happens. They ask, do you agree with Senator Corker? What do you think about Senator Corker? And it puts all of these senators in a super uncomfortable position, and they've got gigantic things to do instead of all this.
Anybody want to weigh in?
I don't remember the Democrats being so upset about this issue when Hillary Clinton was calling people deplorables and bigoted and all these other things.
Well, she was talking about Republicans.
I agree with you. And she was just a candidate for president, not the president, so that is unbecoming. There's no question
there. But he's talking about their party.
He just has continued the campaign. This is probably the first. It's not 24-hour Fox News. This is almost 25 hours in his head. It's constant. He sleeps and everything.
Wake up at 6 o'clock.
It never stops. And so I don't think he, and the other is, I don't think, yes, it is about his own party, but I don't know that Donald Trump has pretty much made it clear he doesn't like Democrats, but I don't think he's ever made it clear that he likes Republicans either. So I think he may just dislike them less.
But that's where this Corker thing really caught people off guard in a way, though, because they're both real estate developers. They both come from somewhat similar backgrounds. And he seemed to be at least one of the few new friendships, new relationships that Trump built after his election. Corker was one of the first endorsements that he got from the Senate. And, early on, he was looked at as a potential Secretary of State candidate. Their close relationship, which is obviously now frayed in tatters beyond recognition, but they did have the inklings of a lasting friendship there for a little bit.
Trump has a way of making friends with people after he attacks them. I mean, he accused Ted Cruz's father of being involved in murder, and they came together. So
JFK. I mean, just any old murder.
I tend to think that this is somewhat. I think what makes that a little different is Cruz is inherently more political than Corker as a person. And
yeah, but also it's like, do you want your agenda passed or not?
Yeah,
it's,
I mean, that's a good point.
And you need that vote for Iran deal?
Sam, it's October 11th. This year is rapidly disintegrating in front of our eyes, and Republicans haven't accomplished anything significant. They admit that themselves. And the question is President Trump helping get to the point where they'll do something before the new year?
All you have to do is just remember what John McCain has done twice. What has he done twice? He's derailed a significant piece of legislation, the marquee piece of legislation that the Republicans put forward. He derailed it twice. That is one senator.
All right.
Now you add Bob Corker.
I apologize for interrupting you. I've got to get a break in. We'll do that now. There's some really interesting developments in the Atlanta mayor's race, and I do want to talk about them with the panel when we come back. This is Political Rewind.
Wherever news is happening, GPB takes you there, from here in Georgia to the other side of the world. As Hurricane Irma moved into our state, we suspended our fall fun drive in order to provide you with the latest news and information to help keep you and your family safe. The campaign resumes tomorrow, but don't wait to do your part. Your support now is a direct investment in the coverage you rely on from GPB and NPR day after day. Go to gpb.org and click donate. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Wow, jaunty music behind that promotion. Everybody sort of, I guess I was the only one sort of dancing in the studio. let's move on. Atlanta mayor's race is getting closer and closer. Election day is in just about a month or so. And in fact, less than a month now. In fact, early voting starts
Monday.
here's a development that I think is worth talking just a little bit about. Greg Bluestein. Peter Amon has people, like all the candidates, they have people out canvassing, going door to door, asking people for support. Please vote for Peter Amon. Give us a little cash if you can while you're at it. And someone captured video, much to the Amon campaign's embarrassment, of two canvassers for Amon going up to a house that had a Kathy Woolard campaign sign on the front lawn. Let's listen to what happened.
Hello?
We're here canvassing on behalf of the Peter Amon for Atlanta Mayor campaign. We were just wondering if you had some time to talk about the campaign or our candidate.
Did you see the Kathy Woolard sign in the front?
We did, but did you know that she's currently polling at 6th and considering putting her support behind Peter?
He is doing what?
She's currently polling in 6th place. And the rumor has it that she's going to throw her support behind Peter prior to the runoff.
That woman went on to say, "We're having dinner. Leave us alone." Oh, Greg. That, and Kathy, Kathy Willard's already got a spot out accusing Eamon of dirty politics. It's one of those things that happens in a race.
And the I guess the beauty of having a Ring automatic doorbell that takes videos of this.
That's right.
2 years ago, if someone had told a reporter that, you know, that happened, they were like, okay, show us proof. Well, now you have proof. You could hear the disgust in her voice. She's doing what?
Sam Zamerby, have you endorsed a candidate in this race? I should ask that before we talk anymore.
Yes, I have, and I think she's the sleeper, and she is the subject of this segment, and the candidate in the election who is counting votes, and her name is Kathy Willard.
You're a Kathy Willard supporter. Okay, just so we know where things stand. Mark, you are going to have a poll on Channel 2 News, and we do understand that you can't spill the beans before it's on Channel 2. But recent polling, Channel 11 had a poll done by an organization. You might question their methodology of the poll. But what they said is that Mary Norwood remains well out front. There hasn't been a poll yet that hasn't shown Mary Norwood out front, is there?
Not yet.
Okay, and there probably won't be one, I assume, on Channel 2 News tonight. The big question is, Greg, who's next? I mean, is it Keisha Lance Bottoms, who seems to be coming up in other polling that's out there? Is Peter Amon making any moves? We don't. This is all bunched together very tightly in second place and beyond.
Yeah, there's something like 13 candidates. One dropped out, but there's about a dozen candidates in the race, and there's about at least a half dozen with a legitimate shot of sneaking in there. And Keisha Lance Bottoms, a Atlanta City Councilwoman, got a pretty big boost today when Mayor Kasim Reed formally endorsed her. She had been, you know, second, third in some of the recent polls. There haven't been that many, but she had been up in that top echelon in some of the recent polls. And this race could be so close, you know, with so many candidates, that it could be 15%, 16% in that gets you into that runoff in December against Mary Norwood.
Meanwhile, the mayor is furious today because a city council tweet went out saying that the mayor had vetoed the legislation, the ordinance that was passed by the city council, dramatically decreasing the penalties for possession of an ounce or less of marijuana. The tweet said the mayor had vetoed that legislation. In fact, he signed it, and he's blaming Caesar Mitchell, president of city council, for dirty tactics. Sam, take it away.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that the current mayor is blaming Caesar Mitchell for everything. let's get back to this race, because this is going to be a relatively modest turnout. Let's say under 100,000 voters. I think that's the general consensus. And you have Peter Amon running a fairly effective campaign in his own backyard. He's been very steady at it. No one's talked about Vincent Ford, but I will tell you, Vincent Ford has won with 57,000-58,000 votes in repetitive races.
And has Bernie Sanders' support.
Yeah, and so watch Vincent Ford into the Keisha Bottoms base over in the Southwest, and then watch Kathy Willard, because she's running in 6 and 2 as her base with the LBG community.
What do you mean 6 or 2? 6 and 2 districts.
Yes,
all right.
And very strong turnout districts. There's new races in those districts. So my own view is that this race will come down to who has been counting their votes, and who knows where those votes are going to come from, and you'll look for some surprises.
All right, well, there's going to be a lot more interesting developments in this race, there's no question, in the weeks ahead, the next few weeks. Patricia Murphy, we teased at the top of the show, NBC had an exclusive report this morning in which they say that in a meeting with his national security advisor some time ago, President Trump said we need to dramatically increase our nuclear arsenal. What would be involved in that? The reporting says increase it tenfold.
Mm-hmm.
There's no budget for any tenfold increase. There are questions as to whether that's a strategy that anyone other than the president wants to take on. That report to some people is rather alarming in and of itself, yes?
I think so. I think also Carol Lee is a reporter who did that. She used to work for the Wall Street Journal, is incredibly deeply sourced. So you can basically take what she's reporting typically to the bank. So I think it's quite a reliable report. The way she described it, it was more in the context of, that we used to have that number of nuclear weapons. Why can't we now? I think for people who are deeply involved in that area of policy, I think it's more that he it seemed to come as news to him 6 months into his administration, sort of the development of the nuclear triad and just a number of pieces of detail. But I've spoken with a number of people today who said, well, we're not increasing it by tenfold. He has a number of super steady advisors around him.
Yeah.
He, you know, is sort of talking in a private meeting. Why can't he do that? And everything's okay because we're not increasing the we're not buying 90% more nuclear weapons.
So we're running out of time, Greg, but today President Trump fired back at NBC. He suggested that NBC's broadcast license should be pulled as punishment for the network's reporting on his national security meetings. Broadcasters serve at the pleasure of the FCC. They are publicly held licenses, and the government can revoke them. Now, nobody's saying Trump's going to go ahead and do that, but it's a significant escalation in the way he wants to do war against the media.
Yeah, I mean, to my knowledge, it's the first time he's opened this front, this particular threat, which is also from my reading. I'm looking at Politico's story of this right now. The Federal Communications Commission doesn't directly license those networks, so I don't know if it has any teeth.
That's
to it.
Right. That's right. Thank you for reminding me. They license individual stations that carry the programs of the networks, right?
Yeah.
I've only been in broadcasting for 35 years.
But you're right. This does open an entirely new front and a new phase of this long-running battle with us reporters.
Oh, yeah.
The fun part
one
of this
thing
one to
look
me,
forward to.
It, of course, The Apprentice was on what network?
Yeah, I love it.
The wicked, the tangle of webs.
I think there's more here than meets the eye.
Were you an Apprentice fan, Mark, before Trump became a Republican even?
I only listen to radio.
All right. Yes. Good.
Yeah, I enjoyed, right. I enjoyed that. Enjoy it, though.
We're gonna hold on to that and tweak it a little bit so that we have Mark in a promotion say, I only listen to GPB radio. An appropriate promotion
I
on
did
the day
watch,
before
I,
we
I did
start
watch
our
Apprentice.
Fun.
I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Greatly.
We're out of time for today's show. Great discussion, everybody. Mark Roundtree, Landmark Communications pollster. You can look for his new poll of the mayor's race on WSB TV channel. Channel 2 tonight. Sam Zamarripa, the name of your book again is?
The Spectacle of Let, the Oliet and the Obit.
I love that
thank
title.
You.
Patricia
thank
Murphy,
you.
Thank you so much for being here. We really look forward to continuing to read you in Roll Call and The Daily Beast, but now Garden and Gun. And Greg Bluestein, love having you here on Wednesdays with us. Thanks for being here again today.
Thanks for having me.
We're back tomorrow with Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. We have an interesting show. I hope it's an interesting show. You know, I was thinking about the fact that you may wonder, guests come and go on Two-Way Street, and when they leave the studio, do we forget them? Do we never think about them again? Well, the answer is no. We're interested. We've gotten to know them. We've met them. They've become sort of our friends. So we pay attention to what's happening in their lives and careers. And tomorrow we're going to update you on what's happening with three really fascinating guests from this show. The great ocean swimmer, Diana Nyad.
Yes.
Kenny Leon, the Broadway director who's based here in Atlanta. And a country music singer-songwriter who Keith Urban made rich, Radney Foster. We'll tell you what's happening with them now and listen back to some of the highlights of their conversations with us on Two-Way Street. That's tomorrow at 2. And, of course, we'll be back Friday with another edition of Political Rewind at 3. Have a great evening, everybody.